Welcome to episode 20 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. I'm Tony, and the first thing for me to do, I suppose, is to apologise for the late arrival of this episode. None of us planned for it to be this late, but there it is. Now, back in December, Dave and Alan and I went to the Ubuntu Developers Summit in Mountain View in California. While we were there, we met up with Schwuck, who is our website design guru and a Canonical employee, and we interviewed several people, and this show we're going to bring you those interviews. We interviewed Matt Zimmerman, Matthew Paul Thomas, Robert Collins, Graham Binns, and Stuart Langridge. We've also got the result of the competition to win a copy of Ubuntu Kung Fu. Sounds like a fun-packed show. Let's get on with it.
We're here with Matt Zimmerman, who's the CTO of Canonical. Matt, what's going on here at UDS then?
So there are lots and lots of technical discussion, quite a lot of discussion about our community processes. And one session that I really enjoyed the other day, we had an extensive discussion with a huge room of people about what it's like to get into the project and how we can make it easier for people to get involved who want to contribute. But on the whole, I think it's been a great UDS. Certainly, each one is an improvement on the one before. But it's great to be in California. The weather's great. And I think it's going really well.
What's the main thing that you wanted to get out of this UDS personally?
Me personally, my personal goal at UDS tends to be to try to make a positive contribution across everything that's happening, at least get involved in what each team or group of people at the event is doing and help make a contribution there in some way.
So what does a CTO of Canonical do on a day-to-day basis?
I spend a lot of time on the phone, and when I'm not on the phone, I'm typing. And sometimes I do both at once.
About what sort of things?
About all of the engineering work that's going on in the company, the various programs that we're doing, trying to keep people communicating and make things happen.
Okay, so you've been with Ubuntu from the very start. How long is that, and what have you seen change over the distribution over the years?
Wow, so it's been about 4.5 years. So I was first involved in discussions in the project in early 2004 and first came on board full-time with the company about mid-2004. So about 4 months before we put out our first release. So I think most everything has changed since then, really. Certainly the environment at the company has changed a great deal. We're orders of magnitude bigger than we used to be. The process by which we decide what we will do, UDS and all the associated things have changed a lot. They're also a lot bigger and require a lot more planning. The distribution itself has just grown by leaps and bounds, I think. The original 4.10 Wardy release was obviously a bit rough around the edges, put together very quickly. It was the first time for a lot of us in doing just this type of project from the very beginning. And nowadays, I think it's much more of a finished product.
I know when you say Warty was kind of rough around the edges, I know when I switched from Red Hat to Debian, I was impressed with Debian. And then from Debian to Warty, I was really impressed with Warty, and it actually felt right, which is why I've stuck with it all the years. Do you think there's still... Given that Ubuntu, I think, has helped other distros to improve and raise their game as well, do you think we still have the edge over other distros? Do you think we can still pull people in from other distros?
Well, I think more and more it's about bringing people into open source and computing more so than between distros. I think Ubuntu is for many people their first introduction to Linux now, and that's something that I'm incredibly proud of. I think it's a great first impression to make on people who've never used open source software before. Going back to Wardy, I mean, most of the people who started using it at that time were people who had been using Debian and were looking for something which was an improvement on that. And now it's a first port of call for people who are looking for something new and interesting in open source.
When Canonical was a lot smaller, did you have much more of a hands-on technical role? And do you miss that if you don't do that so much now?
Yeah, I used to write quite a bit of code. I'm not really doing very much of that anymore. I still like to experiment and work at a technical level, and I do enjoy it. But it's a very different challenge, managing a large technical team, and I enjoy that very much as well. So I do miss it sometimes, but I certainly don't regret the path that I've taken.
Given Ubuntu is comprised of a number of other upstream projects. Do you feel it's difficult to drive the direction of Ubuntu given you're dependent upon all those upstream projects?
So actually, I'd say I look at it more as an opportunity. But the fact that we have so much inspiration to draw from all of these projects lets us see what's possible and what we can do. And so more than anything, I think it makes it possible more than makes it difficult.
Now, we would all like some extra development in certain areas of Ubuntu. Is there a specific area or areas that you would like to see improved in the next release?
One area that seems to be a source of a lot of frustration for a variety of users is the audio subsystem. It's from the kernel all the way up to applications. It's overcomplicated. It's been done and redone in several different ways, and could really do with a thorough cleanup. We've had some good discussions about it this week and elsewhere, and I hope that there's some work to be done there. But I think it's probably going to be a slow process to get everyone to converge on a standard API and components there. But I think it does need to happen. It's not in the state that we'd like to see it right now.
So if sound is one way in which we can improve over, I guess that's going to be over successive releases of Ubuntu, what specifically are you looking forward to in this release? What's piqued your interest here at UDS for the jaunty cycle?
Well, I think I'd say that if we can get the kernel layer right, if the basic ALSA API works well for a majority of the people here at this conference, for example, I think they will have done a good job.
One of your other hats is also on the technical board, isn't it, for the Ubuntu technical board. What do they actually do?
So the Ubuntu technical board is one of the two primary governing bodies of Ubuntu, the other being the community council. So the technical board is responsible for the set of things that have to do with technical standards and processes in the distribution. We set standards for when we'll allow new developers into the project and what their access privileges will be. When there's a technical decision that needs to be made, that's either someone needs some help or there's a conflict and it needs to be resolved, then they call on the technical board and we try to help them or take a decision where that needs to be done.
Yeah. So in some ways, either an advisory role or a decision-making role.
Yes, I like to think so. As the project has grown, the technical board's a very small group of people, and obviously not all of the technical decisions that are made can go through that group, but we try to help out when we are called upon.
Having been with Canonical since day one, basically, over the last 4 years, do you think in another 4 years we'll have tackled bug number one?
I think 4 years might be a bit ambitious, but I certainly have high hopes for the next few years in terms of continuing adoption of Ubuntu and becoming a real phenomenon in the world outside of open source, and people who are buying netbooks and people who are buying consumer electronics devices getting introduced to it. I think that's the next wave of excitement that I'm looking forward to.
I mean, this time 18 months ago, I would never have predicted seeing Ubuntu on mobile devices, but they're everywhere now, and it's a really good team and a really thriving area of the company. Are there any other new areas that you could see us getting into in future?
Well, there are a couple of really interesting new things going on at Canonical in that area. One of them is the desktop experience project. David Barth and his team are looking at ways to radically improve the user interface and experiment with some new design concepts there. And also the online services program, which has been talked about some here at UDS, I think will offer Ubuntu users some really interesting and useful technology that they don't have access to today.
Okay, well, thanks for talking to us today, Matt.
All right, thank you very much.
We're here with Matthew Paul Thomas from the design team of Canonical. Hello, Matthew. What are you doing here at UDS?
Many, many things. I'm helping with the design of various features in the installer and the desktop and occasionally in the server. I'm involved in meetings of the design team itself and the desktop experience team that we're working closely with.
What's there to design on the server?
Well, the server team is currently in charge of everything to do with virtualization, and there are some things to do with setting up virtual machines that need to be easier. There are also details of the server installer that I hope to help out with.
From my point of view, design sounds like putting buttons in the right place and colors and, being very simplistic.
I'm sure it's much more than that. What kind of considerations need to be taken into account when designing applications on?
Right. Well, there's about half a dozen factors that you usually consider in usability. There's learnability, how easy it is for someone who's coming across it the first time to use it. Efficiency, once you have learnt it, how easy is it to do something quickly. There's forgiveness, if you make a mistake, how easy is it to recover. And aesthetics and pleasantness, how satisfied is someone when they've finished their task. Sometimes these factors compete with each other, and so you have to make a trade-off, but often they you can achieve all of them at once.
Presumably you work quite closely with the artwork team. So who actually leads the direction with the artwork? Do they come up with ideas and bring them to you, or do you say, hey, should we try this? How does that work?
Well, Ken Weimer is the coordinator of the artwork team. So far, the design team is so new, it's only a couple of months old, that we haven't really had much interaction with the artwork team yet. But I expect we will have more discussions with them as we go on, deciding on, you know, what the splash screen should look like, what kind of backgrounds we should provide, that sort of thing.
How do you find the interaction between your team and developers? I mean, obviously, you're sometimes going to be pointing out that developers are doing it wrong and they need to be doing it differently. And how do you find they take your suggestions or recommendations?
In general, it's very good. It's all about the way you phrase it. I mean, when I started out in free software, I was in the Mozilla project, and I'll be the first to admit that the approach I took wasn't that helpful a lot of the time. So I gradually learned that you need to say, rather than just saying, oh, this is all terrible, you need to say, okay, well, if you did it this way, it would be more learnable. If you did it this way, people would make fewer mistakes. And many of those things are like programming things. There's things like, you know, refactoring to simplify the code applies also to the interface. You can refactor the interface to have fewer elements in it, to have fewer entities in it, just like you'd have fewer variables in a program. And so if you explain it in that way, often programmers can understand it. And the Ubuntu developers, because Ubuntu is the Linux for human beings, of course, they tend to be very keen on making it usable and making it a pleasure to use.
Is there a different approach you take when talking with developers who are core Ubuntu developers, or developers who are upstream outside the Ubuntu project, as it were?
Yeah, well, with the Ubuntu developers, often they come to me and say, hey, I need help with this particular feature, and that's great. With the upstream developers, often it's me going to them and hanging out in their IRC channel and joining their mailing list and saying, you know, Ubuntu's considering doing something this way, would you be keen on helping us out or doing it the same way upstream?
How wide is your remit? Is it just to concentrate on the programs that are installed by default, or the ones in main, or everything that Ubuntu makes available?
It's even wider than all of those. The design team is not just about Ubuntu, it's about everything that Canonical puts out. So also about Launchpad, Landscape, the Ubuntu.com website, the online services, everything that Canonical does. As far as Ubuntu is concerned, most of my interest is with the programs that are shipped by default, partly in choosing which ones they are, partly in trying to improve their interface.
So the effectiveness of a UI may influence whether that program is chosen over another one for inclusion in default Ubuntu installations?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things I did in the last cycle was a comparison of Empathy and Pigeon, comparing their user interface and as well as their feature set and their maturity. And as far as the user interface was concerned, I came to the conclusion that Pigeon was more polished, more mature, and that was one of the factors that led us to continue using Pigeon in Intrepid rather than Empathy.
So is there a continual process of reviewing applications, and nothing's got a sacred place in Ubuntu?
No, I mean, that was just the first example of it. You have to be careful not to just switch too often. Even if one application would have temporarily overtaken another, you need to be careful that you're not causing too much churn amongst the user base. So it's not the only factor, but it is a factor.
So in going from what you said there, I'm wondering whether or not we can expect to see Thunderbird anytime soon as a replacement for Evolution.
Well, I use Thunderbird myself. I mean, the main problem with Thunderbird, though, is that it's not a native GTK application. I realize that Firefox has the same issue, but Firefox has enough of a feature set advantage over Epiphany, especially with all the extensions that we consider it as the default browser. Also has the branding. With Thunderbird, that advantage isn't so great. Email is a tricky problem for Ubuntu, because we're not really... Each of the available options has many disadvantages as well as many advantages. And so it's a tricky problem, and it's... Even if we wanted to put some development into it ourselves, it would be a big hole to dig into.
So what sort of things are you looking at for Jaunty then?
Many, many things. So the main things that we've announced this week from the design team specifically and the desktop experience team that's implementing our designs is some changes to the notification bubbles that pop up to notify you of things like new instant messages, that downloads are finished, that sort of thing. And to go alongside that, a new panel applet to let you know that new instant messages have arrived, new email messages have arrived, so that you have fewer icons in the panel. You don't need one for Pigeon, one for Evolution, one for XChat. You can just have one that tells you, hey, there's messages that concern you. So that's the things we're specifically working on the design team for this cycle. There are other things that feature teams are working on, like improving their partitioning in the installer, that sort of thing.
That seems to be an area of that's a bit fraught. I've recently had experience of a friend trying to install Ubuntu, and he's quite an expert technical user, but the partitioning screen completely confused him. Now, partitioning is not a simple task. How can you reduce that down and make the complexity of having multiple partitions spread across multiple disks of different types, how can you reduce that down to make it simpler for someone to use?
I'm not sure yet, and part of the difficulty of it, I mean, we've known this has been a problem since Edgy, if not earlier, but any improvement in it would be quite a big undertaking. What I'm hoping to do this cycle is draw up half a dozen or a dozen different possible layouts, how we might present the various options, then possibly do some paper prototyping, which means showing those to various users and saying, would you understand this? You know, what would you click to do this? And seeing how well they understand it.
I guess we're in an unenviable situation with respect to that, because with Windows, you either get it pre-installed or it just wipes your whole disk, usually. With the Mac, you get it pre-installed also. So we're kind of in a bit of a losing starting position, because we have this complexity of having to cope with multiple partitions already on the disk and adding new partitions, and that can't be easy, I guess.
Right. I mean, the closest any proprietary system comes to this is Mac OS X when you install Boot Camp, and all you have to do there is set up two partitions and decide how big you want each one. So the interface is fairly simple. For us, it will be more complicated. I mean, this is... I see occasionally people argue that, oh, you know, Ubuntu is so much easier to install than Windows, and conveniently forgetting that in most cases you don't have to install Windows. So part of making Ubuntu easier to install is getting it on more computers pre-installed. That is part of the equation.
And probably from a blank disk install, it is arguably easier than the Windows installer. But as soon as you have another partition, as Alan says, it just causes so much mayhem. If the installer can just take over the disk and just do what it likes, it's okay, but you've got swap partitions to set up. You might want to have separate partitions for a encrypted home directory that we may see in Jaunty, and it starts to become non-trivial, even if the end result is probably better.
That's true. Yeah, the encrypted home partition is one of the things that I'll be looking at either today or tomorrow to try and improve the design. And one of the other possibilities, for example, is to hide the swap partition option so that you would just specify a space for Ubuntu and the installer would choose the swap partition size automatically. That's one possibility that we're considering.
I think that's kind of what it does at the moment, isn't it? It says what it looked like before and what it looked like, and it just says Ubuntu, a big chunk of space, and it doesn't actually say some of it is swap. So we're getting there.
Yes, we are. I mean, but then you still have the advanced partitioning step. So you have the before chart, the after chart that you can drag around, and then you have the advanced chart, which have three different appearances. And one of the things I'm hoping to do is to consolidate those and make them look more similar.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for talking to us today, and enjoy the rest of the summit.
Thank you very much, Tony.
So we're here with Robert Collins, who works for Canonical. And actually, Robert, I don't know what you do for Canonical. So give us a rundown of what you do for Canonical.
Oh, I'm on the Bazaar team. So I'm one of the principal developers for the BZR version control system. It's a collection of plugins. And that's kind of it. Although it's full-time, there's no real opportunity at the moment to go and look at different things.
For those who don't know, what is Bazaar and why should we care what it is and what you do and how great it is?
Bazaar is a revision control system. It's a distributed version control system which allows everyone to have the same power as you might get in CVS or Subversion, where there's a trunk and only a few people can commit. In a distributed revision control system, everybody can commit. And they can do that on their own machines. It's got no risk to the people who are maintaining the project, but it lets everyone come up and be at the same level. It's egalitarian. You've all got the same access to the tool chain. You don't have a second-class citizen just because you're not yet a committer. And we hope that Bazaar will become a integral part of the Ubuntu tool chain, because Ubuntu has a very large number of contributors, all of whom need to get their code into Ubuntu, but don't necessarily have the privilege of being able to put it straight in at this point. So the ability to access history for Ubuntu packages themselves is currently quite limited. And one of the things we've been spending some considerable time on the last cycle and during Jaunty is to get everything that's in Ubuntu in BZR and accessible on the web for anyone to grab, edit, and then upload their new version.
So it has significant advantages over traditional things like CVS or Subversion, but there are other similar tools like Git.
Is that a leading question?
Not really. I don't know.
Yeah, there's a bunch of distributed version control tools around today. The three most popular ones, the ones that turn up when people are doing selections, are Git, BZR, and HG. From a technical perspective, there are more in common with each of these tools than there is different when compared to something like CVS or Subversion. BZR is very, very good at handling renames and tree shape changes, where you rename a directory, add files, remove files, and the sort of stuff you do when you're cleaning up your code. Git is sort of world-renowned for being fast. Someone did a blog post a few days ago talking about aiming a sniper rifle at your foot and pulling the trigger because you just don't realize you've done it yet. And he was using Git. He also uses BZR, which is why he's got a comparison. HG is similar age to Git and BZR. I think the thing they've focused on most in their development is the sort of patch queue workflow, because it was developed by people who contribute to the Linux kernel, but they didn't want to use Git. So they have a workflow that lets them generate patches to be pushed out to Git quite easily.
And did BZR start as an offshoot of something required by the Ubuntu project, or did it already exist? What's the history of BZR?
Right at the beginning of Ubuntu, we recognized that scaling out package management and package editing to a vast crowd required the same tools that you use for developing individual packages, but at that scale. There was a choice at that point between a thing called TLA and a thing called Subversion. Subversion wasn't anywhere near as robust or as scalable as it is today, and TLA, it was distributed. And distributed, really, can't keep coming back to it, but it's a key social difference between systems. So TLA, we started contributing to. I was hired to work on using TLA in Ubuntu before it was called Ubuntu. And we didn't get quite the traction that we needed. The tool wasn't quite what it needed to be. The Bazaar project was formed to say, okay, we're going to really focus on delivering what the Ubuntu users need and what hopefully something that everyone will find really, really lovely and fantastic to use. And the current Bazaar code base was created when we realized the design of Arch wasn't one that could scale in the way we needed it to scale.
And there seems to be quite a lot of integration between BZR and Launchpad. Is that something that was designed from the ground up or something that's evolved over time? And also further, is it really a requirement to use Launchpad or a Launchpad-type tool with BZR, or can you get away with BZR on its own?
So Launchpad and BZR are integrated by design. A lot of Launchpad's code management stuff could have been done by, you know, inventing something completely separate, but Launchpad wants to use BZR and work closely with BZR branches, whether they're hosted on Launchpad or not. The easiest way to get a BZR branch hosted is to just push it to Launchpad. Anyone can do that, free account, sign up, and it just works. BZR ships with integration with Launchpad, and that gets improved over time. it's important that BZR work well for people who are working on proprietary code behind firewalls and their own stuff. So it's got a full capability without Launchpad. But Launchpad adds in social networking because you can see people who are working on the same project that you're working on. It aids with code reviews, bug management. You can say, I'll fix this bug over here, and you can get the code for it. So they fit very well together. They complement each other.
A lot of people who are familiar with normal version control systems struggle with the concept of distributed. Why is it so good?
It just is.
Fair enough.
There's a certain amount of, in the country of the blind here, I can describe it, but you've actually tried it and had the penny drop, it can be hard to get. We had at FOSCamp here just last week, right before Ubuntu, the author, I think he's the lead developer, he's certainly very high up in the Bacula community, and he'd been trying to get to grips with Launchpad and to move off Subversion onto Bazaar. And we spent an hour-long session where we were talking around a bunch of different things, and we talked some stuff over with him. And during that session, you could just see the light go, ding, came on, he got it. And he said, okay, wow, okay, great. And after that, it all just worked for him. So there is certainly a cognitive divide that you need to jump across as you learn a new tool chain. I think the advice I'd tend to give someone who is learning it is to not worry about their own code. Grab someone else's code that's already in Bazaar, something small, play with it, learn how the thing interacts, how the tools work, rather than worrying about, I've got to migrate my stuff right up front before I can learn the tool. Or even just start with a completely empty project. Play around with it, junk, push it up to Launchpad and the plus junk directory where you can put any old crap that you want. And it should only take a couple of hours when you're doing something with no consequences if you get it wrong before you're completely comfortable. And then after that, get your own code and away you go.
So you have a set of features that you've designed into BZR. Are there any unexpected uses that you've seen that people are using BZR for?
I haven't seen anything that was sort of stunning. I didn't think you could do that sort of stuff. Lars Vazanius has a habit of putting Bazaar right through its paces and giving it extremely large workloads or deep history and things like that as experimentation. He does that to find the limits of the system rather than really being a sort of useful use case. I did as an experiment about 6 months ago, put all of Ubuntu source as one, just, you know, unpacked all of the source into one big directory and disk and threw it into BZR. That could have worked better, and some of the scaling work we're doing now to give performance on normal trees will add that sort of extreme case.
If you want to store large binaries in Bazaar, how do you do it?
BZR init, BZR add, BZR commit.
Just the same as you would for any other type of file.
Okay, and you make a slight change to that binary and then you store it. Have you doubled up on yourself?
No.
Okay, so just so you put an ISO, I mean, offer.
Okay. No, we're doing a bloody interview. Yeah.
Hang on. Okay, so if you put an ISO in there, yeah, and then you did a reburn, so basically 90% of it is going to be identical, then you're saying that if you replace that with one, like a daily image, it wouldn't restore the whole binary?
That's correct.
I didn't know Bazaar did that.
Bazaar aims to just work. That's really the key thing. If it doesn't just work, it's a bug and we'll fix it.
Bazaar can work with other version control systems like Subversion. How many more are there that can do that, and how many people really using it that way?
So the foreign tree stuff, the BZR Subversion plugin, is fantastic. Most VCS systems have some sort of converters available so that they can get data out and push it into another system. There's a thing called Fast Export, which has become a bit of a de facto standard recently, and BZR supports that. BZR SVN is unique because it actually provides the BZR code at a model level, as an object inside our internal classes, direct access to Subversion. So you can run BZR log, you can run the BZR web viewer logger here, or even the BZR index, but you can do a BZR index and then a BZR search directly against Subversion. And this works. It's obviously limited by the sort of resolution of the Subversion repository, and until recently they didn't even do merges. But these are what it can infer from Subversion is exposed as first class objects to our code. So all of the tool chain works. And, yeah, a lot of people pull stuff across. There's an entire mirror of all of GNOME at bzrplayground.gnome.org. It's got everything in Subversion pulled directly across with Beezer SVN. It's a lot nicer than the other integration tools I've seen for SVN because they generally are wrappers around Git, so around e.g. Git or HG. You run this wrapper and it pulls some stuff out. And, okay, that's fine, but you can't just put an SVN URL in and have it work, which is what you can do with Beezer. So you can Beezer log SVN colon slash slash svn.gnome.org/evolution/trunk and it will just work.
So can we talk to any more or is it just Subversion?
Subversion is the most mature. There is a Beezer Git and a Beezer HG that Yael Mivouni is currently doing a bunch of work on. I can't really speak to their polish, but they're not at the degree of end-user simplicity that Beezer SVN is at. Beezer SVN is probably the most important, though, from our perspective, because there's a huge number of Subversion repositories out there that we need to interoperate with.
One thing I understand, there are a few GUI front ends for BZR. Can you comment on any of them?
There are. I mean, part of this is platform-specific. Different platforms require different GUIs. There's a thing called TBZR on Windows, which integrates with the Windows Explorer, so you can right-mouse-click anywhere, and it comes up with a context menu and so on and so forth. We do have some integration with Nautilus for that in the BZR GTK package, but due to some technical issues, it doesn't perform that well. There is a standalone GUI in the BZR GTK package called Olive, and there's a bunch of commands which will allow you to get GUI results out of BZR, but you fire them off from the command line if you're not using Olive. So Olive acts a bit like a file explorer, a shell, a GUI shell. There's a thing called QBZR, which is a Qt-based BZR GUI, and a bunch of people like that. I believe it's been used as a sort of standalone GUI for Windows by quite a few people. There's BZR Eclipse, which is Eclipse integration for BZR. There's gedit BZR, which is gedit integration for BZR. What's that? NetBeans? I think there's a NetBeans project going along. I don't know how far it's gone. The list goes on.
Cool. One last question. Bazaar or BZR?
Yes.
I think we should call it a knock it on the head there, actually. That's a good way to end it.
My pleasure.
Thank you very, very, very much indeed.
So, in the last episode, we had a competition. And what was the question, Tony?
The question was, how many tips are there in the Ubuntu Kung Fu book by Keir Thomas? And we wanted to know the exact number, preferably. Or if nobody got quite the right number, we would take the closest answers. But fortunately, about 17 people got exactly the right answer.
And what was the answer, Alan?
It was 315. And the winner is Matt Bailey. So we're going to send you a copy of the book, the copy that we reviewed. So it's been thumbed a little bit, but not too badly.
Yes, and thankfully Matt seems to live in the UK, which is makes shipping it a lot easier. So if you can email us your postal address, Matt, from the email address you used to enter the competition, we'll send it off to you.
Which should mean we would post it within the next month, I expect.
We're joined by Graham Binns, who works on Launchpad. Graham, what are you doing here in UDS?
So here at UDS, I've mostly been around to take a kicking from the Ubuntu community. No, what I've actually been here for is to talk to all the different people, all the different tracks that are at UDS. So there's one for the kernel team, one for the server team, one for the community, yada, yada, yada. And the idea is that I talk to them and listen to their concerns about Launchpad and try and find some solutions to their problems.
Sorry, can you just explain briefly what Launchpad is?
Launchpad is a collaborative software development platform. So it has a bug tracker, a code hosting service, an answer tracker, which is a bit used to build FAQs and deal with help requests and stuff like that. It also does translations and a number of other things. And it's used for all Ubuntu development. So whenever there's a release of Ubuntu, it's all managed through Launchpad. All the packages are managed in Launchpad, and all the bugs that are filed against the packages in Ubuntu are filed in Launchpad.
And you work mainly on the bug tracker part of Launchpad, is that right?
Yes, that's correct. There are seven teams in Launchpad. There's 35 developers in all, so it's roughly five people to a team, each working on the different components. And yeah, my main focus is the bug tracker.
Now, over the years, Launchpad has had some criticism for not being open source, but you had some news this week, didn't you?
Yes. So Mark Shuttleworth announced at the last OzCon, which was last July, that Launchpad was going to be open sourced. And at this UDS, Kiko Rees, who is the Launchpad head honcho, announced that the date for open sourcing of Launchpad will be the 21st of July 2009.
Oh, you understand that was a surprise to you as much as us?
It did come up as a bit of a surprise, yeah. I mean, we knew that we were going to be doing the open sourcing within the next 6 months, but no one had actually put a date on it, and it suddenly comes a lot closer when somebody does that. I think, actually, Kiko sort of basically picked exactly 1 year after Mark made the announcement. I don't think there's any particular pragmatic reason for it.
So what have you got to do to get it all ready?
So the main problem with Launchpad to get it all ready is the fact that the code base needs a bit of reorganising. It's organised in such a way that it is kind of sane, but it could be a lot better subdivided between the different applications in Launchpad. So bug tracker code should go in one place, translations code should go in another, and at the moment it's all kind of jumbled in together. And the one thing that we really want to do before we open source it is make it easier for people to contribute, and to be able to contribute to it you've got to be able to understand the code base. Documentation wise it's pretty good, so our main concern is just tidying things up.
Now when he announced that, you also spoke about the new upcoming release. Now I mean, to the end user they might not see a new release, but I understand it's a big thing for you. Version 3?
Yes, version 3 will be the release at which we open source Launchpad. So we with Launchpad we do one release every month, more or less anyway, and the next actual release of Launchpad will be 2.1.12, which will come out sometime in the next week or so. But we're working towards the major goal of 3.0, which will start the last six release cycles this year. One of the major complaints about it is that it's very slow, particularly over high latency connections, say from South America or from Australia. And we need to do a lot of work on that. So we're going to be rejigging the interface and hopefully doing a lot of work on the back end to speed things up.
There's one part of Launchpad that's not going to be open source, is that right?
That's correct, yes. The back end to Soyuz, which is the software that builds all the packages for Ubuntu, won't be open sourced. Now, there are various pragmatic reasons for that that I don't really know the answers to, but one of the things that has been pointed out is that it takes an awful amount of infrastructure to run that. Canonical has quite a lot of servers just running the build farm for Soyuz. I don't know if it's going to be open sourced in the future, but at the moment the plan is to not open source that part of Launchpad.
Is that related to the PPA Personal Package Archives, or is that totally separate?
It is related. Yeah, it's the piece of software that builds the PPAs, but the code for actually managing the PPAs and what have you will be open source. So it's a bit of a fuzzy line, yeah, between what's going to be open and what's open sourced there.
For myself, I don't have a problem with that, because as far as I'm concerned, the major benefit of open sourcing Launchpad is for people to be able to help contribute code, and also if people do need an answer tracker or a support tracker for managing other projects, then I think that's great. So,
but doesn't that mean there's a chunk missing? So if I take the code for Launchpad and I make my own internal Launchpad for my company, which is a perfectly valid reason for using the open source version of Launchpad, I won't then be able to build Debs using the code provided, using Launchpad for my desktops and my servers.
There is kind of a solution to that. My understanding of it, being a bug tracker guy, is a little fuzzy. But as I understand it, there is going to be some work going into making it possible to use an external instance of Launchpad to push stuff to the Soyuz build farm, and have the Soyuz build farm do the legwork for you. But yes, there is that argument. But again, it comes back to infrastructure. And I'm fairly certain that if a corporation were to need that kind of infrastructure, they'd be able to talk to Canonical, and Canonical could work with them as a commercial partner.
Is the OpenSUSE one open source, their build facility?
I have absolutely no idea about it.
I don't think so.
Because everyone's complaining about Launchpad not being open source, but neither is the OpenSUSE one.
This is true. So come 31st of July next year, once it's all, well, the bits that are going to be open sourced are open sourced, what will we be able to download and run for ourselves?
To download and run, you'll be able to get the bug tracker, the answer tracker, translations management, all the the gubbins to deal with packages and projects and users. So basically the front end for Launchpad, everything you can see and interact with in the front end, you'll get. The stuff that you won't get is the stuff that does the building of packages on the back end. But you'll still get the stuff as well for handling remote bug trackers. The idea is that we will hopefully get to the point where different Launchpad instances can all sync with one another. And there then becomes this blurring of the lines between what's tracked in one bug tracker and what's tracked in another, and you'll be able to see the same bugs from any.
And will it be branded as Launchpad still, or will it be a generic installation or a generic product of which Launchpad is one instance?
I'm not actually sure. We've had a lot of discussions about this, and I think the current plan is to have the software that we release called Launchpad and launchpad.net be the canonical instance of that, and then each person can rebrand it however they like. I think various things like trademarks will be kept. I think that launchpad.net is a trademark of Canonical, but I'm not 100% certain.
So Graham, I'm sure you're sick and tired of talking about Launchpad this week, so what have you got out of UDS that's nothing to do with Launchpad?
The thing I get out of UDS the most is meeting other people who use Ubuntu and talking about how we can improve Ubuntu. I don't do a huge amount of Ubuntu-specific development because I spend so much of my time concentrating on Launchpad, but I've spoken to a lot of people this week who are really scarily smart and had a lot of excellent discussions about how different bits of Ubuntu can be improved. I sat down today with Jano Bacon of the internet, and...
Are you including him in the category of scarily smart?
No, just scary.
I would like to retract my earlier statement for the purposes of Bacon. I sat down earlier with the internet's Jono Bacon and Celeste Lynn Paul, KDE usability guru, and we had a conversation about how we can make usability more workable on by the common developer. One of the things that often gets talked about is fixing bugs and fixing issues in software, but usability is a really hard concept for the majority of engineers to deal with. And we were having a fairly in-depth discussion about how we can help free software developers work on usability issues, try new interface designs and work on usability experiments. And that kind of conversation you can only really have at UDS, and it's absolutely a fantastic place to be.
And I understand you're going to be inflicting your musical skills on us at some point.
Yes, I will.
What do you play?
I play bass and guitar and a couple of other things that we don't have here, so it's going to... Tomorrow night it's going to be bass and guitar. We've got a set list, but the last time we had a set list in Prague, it got completely ignored. So I suspect you might find some invention going on stage, which is never a bad thing. Once again, I mean, you wouldn't expect it at a free software conference, but I'll be playing on stage with the internet's Jono Bacon of Severed Fifth fame. Although I did discover on Tuesday night that he only knows one note. I'll be playing with the scary musical genius that is Luke Jelovic, who plays the drums and the piano frighteningly well, and I'm sure we're all going to have a great time.
Now, Graham, I understand you're doing a podcast for Launchpad. Can you tell us about that and where we can get that?
Yeah, Matt Revelle, who is the Launchpad community and documentation guy, and I have been doing Launchpod for quite a while now. You can find it at news.launchpad.net. It's released hopefully every week, sprints and other things interrupting occasionally. And what we tend to discuss are new Launchpad features, where things are going, and we try and interview people who are using Launchpad in new and interesting ways, as well as talking to the different Launchpad developers. So it's actually quite a fun-packed show.
Whoa, that's trademarked.
Excellent. Well, thank you for talking to us today, Graham.
Thank you very much.
We're here with Stuart Langridge, who is a Canonical employee, or will be a Canonical employee, yeah, and also used to be on a podcast, I think.
I did used to be on a podcast, yes, but obviously not as good as yours.
No, obviously not.
We have that on tape.
That is a quote.
So what are you doing here at UDS?
they asked me to come over and meet up with my team for the first time, see what was going on, participate in some of the sessions, that kind of thing.
What area are you working in at Canonical?
Online services.
Now, can you tell us much about that?
No.
So, what have you made of UDS?
It's been really interesting. I mean, one of the things that I think is interesting about it is that it's a conference which is genuinely for work. Most conferences, you know, you go and you watch a talk, so you do a talk or whatever, and people will sit around in the hallways and chat. But it's very much an experience to be there. But here there's much more an atmosphere of people are genuinely here to work. People will have sprints while they're here. You've got people in sessions who are explaining stuff because it's their job to do so. So it feels much more like something which is genuinely actually part of your job rather than a jolly away from your job.
And the bizarre thing being that some people are paid to be here by Canonical, and there's a whole bunch of people who are community people who aren't paid to be here, who volunteer to come.
Absolutely. I mean, that I think is great. I've sat in on a couple of the community sessions because for the first time I'm seeing this from the other side, you know, part of the Ubuntu community, yes. Now, nearly, I'm a Canonical employee, so I get to see this from the other side of the fence, and you think, wow, there's loads of people here who are not Canonical employees. It's strange.
What do you make of the atmosphere in places like the community room? Obviously you know some of the people in there, but there's a lot of people I guess you don't know.
I know a fair few people, but there's an awful lot of people here I don't know. There's an awful lot of people here who I've spoken to or emailed or whatever, but I've never met. To me, the atmosphere in the community room seems more chatty than the other rooms. The other rooms are very, very technical, very detail-heavy. There's a certain amount more of geeing people up to talk about stuff, whereas the community room is very much more a kind of bantery thing. I mean, some of that's because I think Jono's running it. Some of that is because it's the community room, so the subjects they're talking about are inherently less technical.
Somebody did say that there was an almost a Lug Radio-style ding-dong kicking off between you and Jono at one point.
That's because Jono's wrong about the nature of process. But yeah, I mean, that was entertaining, actually, I think. I mean, I tried to avoid doing that kind of thing too much, obviously.
I heard that Jono was the inspiration for the XKCD cartoon, where it says that somebody is wrong on the internet. And if you hover over it, the tip says, actually, it's Jono. So what are the other sessions you've looked at, the non-community ones?
I've sat in on a couple which were, frankly, a bit too technical for me. Because this is my first UDS, I've got no real idea of what's relevant, what's heavily technical, what isn't. And I wasn't here for the first 2 days anyway, because I was on a sprint with my team. So when I came, I went to a GDM session. I thought, oh, it'll be interesting, find out what the new version of GDM is like. And a lot of it was...
Sorry, can you just explain what GDM is?
GDM is the thing you log into. When you start an Ubuntu machine, or start a GNOME machine, you get the login screen. That's GDM. It stands for GNOME something manager.
Desktop manager.
It is desktop. Right.
I thought it was display.
I thought it was display. And yeah. This is why I didn't say anything. So now you look like a pillock and I don't. So that's GDM. And there's been a reasonable amount of work around making it cooler, different, prettier, whatever. Mirko Muller's been working on something to make it cooler, I think, and there's been various blingy bits. So I thought, oh, I'd like to sit in on that, maybe see some cool screenshots, get an idea of what's coming. And it devolved into a very heavily technical discussion about different X servers that it starts up and so on. And I thought, ooh, you know, I mean, not their fault, absolutely. I was just in the wrong session.
It's quite interesting to me because although there are little bits of announcement and things like that in some of the plenary sessions, for a lot of it, it's just people who've got a very technical brain sitting down and discussing the details of how they're going to implement something. And it's more about them having the convenience of being face-to-face than it is about thinking up brand new ideas and making publicity-seeking announcements.
Yes, I mean, that's exactly what I meant by this feels much more like a conference which is about work. It's not about Canonical people saying, this is what we're doing to community people. It's much more, let's all get together and hash out what we're going to do over the next few months rather than what we have done over the previous few months.
Some of the sessions do actually get you involved as well. I sat in on a very small session about Wubi, the Windows Ubuntu installer, and there was only two guys in there. And I walked in and they were, you know, quite willing to, you know, all huddled around one laptop and show me what was going on and what's new and stuff. And we all discussed some of the options for improving the product. And it's nice to feel that being invited here, you have some input. So, you know, even before you've started working for Canonical, you have input to, you know, what the product, the next version of the product's going to be.
Absolutely. I went this morning to the mobile roundtable. There's a roundtable session every morning. And I went to one of the mobile tracks. I know nothing about the mobile stuff, but I'm quite interested in it. And I just thought, I'll just sit at the back and watch, see what's going on. And the chap running it...
So I was going to say, what defines a round table session as opposed to any other session?
The table is round. Now, the roundtable sessions don't appear to have a specific agenda in mind. I mean, for some, as far as I can tell, there's a roundtable session every morning on every track. So some of the tracks have said, this morning's, you know, Monday morning's one is going to be on this topic, Tuesday morning's one's going to be on this topic. But there's no specific agenda or goal in mind. It's more, let's talk about this subject in kind of a hand-wavy way. So I sat in this morning on the mobile one, and the chap kind of going around the table saying, what have you seen over the last few days that you think would be relevant to the mobile stuff? And he asked me, and I said, I'm just here to watch. He said, no, what have you seen? Like, you know, forced participation. But I said, you know, I've seen this and that and the other. And he said, oh, right, cool, okay. And then they got into a discussion about different clocks.
Was this related to KDE?
Well, the thought did cross my mind, to be honest with you. But it's more kind of what applications do we want to see on the mobile stuff, and more what applications will we like there to be, and then is there an actual existing application to fill that slot?
From what I found, the community one was very excited. There was a lot of like emotion in there when people were talking. You go from there into something like the server room, and everyone's calm, collected, and just taking very slow interchanges. You know, and there was no talk of network block devices, which I know you love. I mean, you should come in. I mean,
absolutely not interested in the network block driver. I think, to be honest with you, that's though, because community stuff is, first of all, something that everyone can genuinely participate in, and secondly, it's something about which is inherently more emotive anyway. If you look at the GDM session I was in, say, there were only three or four people talking in that because only three or four people had the requisite level of knowledge to actually contribute to the discussion. Yeah. Whereas the community thing, they say, well, how do you feel about the idea of the Ubuntu Hall of Fame? Say, everyone can have an opinion on that. I have no opinion on whether GDM should start up a separate X server or not. Don't know. Trust the people who are doing it. You do it. That's fine. As long as I can type in my username and password and log in, that's fine with me. But I do have an opinion on how the Hall of Fame looks and how it should work. I do have an opinion on Canonical's relationship with the community. It's a slightly different opinion now. I'm part of Canonical.
It's also nice to be involved early on, just knowing what's going on. I was in the encrypted swap partition session, and you know, I had very little, if anything, to contribute to the discussion, but it's great to sit there and know what's being planned for the next version and have some kind of idea of what's building up for the next version. Do you find that you've learned stuff about what's going to be in Jaunty or what might be in Jaunty?
Yes, completely. I mean, that's why I think Tony's videos thing is interesting, because people who can't be here for whatever reason, they didn't get sponsored or they don't live in San Francisco or they didn't want to blow £18,000 on flying here or whatever, can still find out. It's kind of a sneak preview, yeah, almost. I mean, I'm surprised there aren't more people who are here purely to find out, but I suppose the Ubuntu community and to some extent Canonical don't want this to turn into Macworld. You know, it's not here as a pretty marketing demo of all the cool stuff that you get your hands on if you're prepared to pay. It's here so you can say, I think we should have this cool stuff, and then everyone's going to say, well, how?
Excellent. So what's the major thing you're going to take away from this week?
Cool, that's a hard question.
Free T-shirt.
I say, apart from the T-shirt.
Oh, well, apart from my free T-shirt, hooray. That's not the major thing I'm going to take away. Come all the way to America, get a free T-shirt, go home again. I may leave my voice here while I'm here. Major thing is the sense of purpose, I think. I didn't realise, like I said, just how much this is work. It's actually... That's not to say that it's bad or it feels like, you know, a drudgy day at the office, because it doesn't, not at all. But the sense of purpose that people are having. You know, everyone who thinks, oh, well, there are six sessions on now and none of them are really relevant to me, sit at the corridors and hack on stuff. I've had the chance to meet up with my team, and they're all great bunch of guys, you know. So that's what I think I'm going to take away, the fact that I've met everybody and now I know we're doing well.
Excellent. Thank you for talking to us.
Thanks. No worries.
Well, that about wraps up Season 1 of the Ubuntu UK podcast. Thanks for joining us over the last 20 episodes. We're going to be taking a break now, but in the meantime, you can join us on Twitter at twitter.com/UUPC or identica.ca/UUPC. Or you can find us on Facebook. Search for Ubuntu UK podcast. You can continue to send your emails to podcast@ubuntu-uk.org, where we welcome your suggestions for the show, recorded material, tips, reviews, and rants. Or you can leave us up to 30 seconds of voicemail on 0845 508 1986. If you're into IRC, you can find us on #ubuntu-uk on the Freenode IRC network. it only remains for me to thank our mirrors, bitfolk.com, Nefalo, and Martin Meredith. That's all for now. Bye-bye.